Welcome all, welcome guests. If we have any guests with us for the first time tonight, we welcome guests at any time at any of our meetings. If you want to become a member, you can go to our homepage and click on the Join or Renew button at the top, and it'll lead you through the process to do that. And I think that's it for announcements, so we will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Hey. Good evening, everyone. And I'm actually going to turn it straight back to Chris because he's lost some emails, apparently.
Well, it's an interesting thing. If you're ever searching for emails in Gmail, Gmail is a little bit odd, shall we say, and I think most people have come across that. And so I'm going to go through, if you've lost something or somebody says they sent something to you, and you can't find it, all might not be lost. So, you know, where the heck is that email that's missing? So either disappears from right in front of you or never shows up in the first place, and you need that email, and some of the standard searching doesn't seem to turn up the email. So you can use the search box, and in this case, I just typed in a search term, XYZZY, and it comes back saying no messages. And I say, well, I know that there is that email somewhere. So I'm going to assume that you have not emptied the trash, because if it was in the trash and you emptied the trash, it's gone and it's not recoverable. So other than that, the email's got to be somewhere there. So you can go to the advanced search, and just below the search box, there's the advanced search button, or you can click on the show search options. We'll bring you to the same dialog box. This is actually very useful. So you can go in and you can fine tune your search rather than searching for X, Y, Z, Z, Y, no matter where it is, in a subject or the body of the message or anything like that. But you can also fine tune it to things like size of it, when it was sent, and things like that. And you'll see that the box that says search and it says all mail. And you might be forgiven if you think that it actually searches all mail. The trouble is, it doesn't actually look in spam or trash. So if an email got sent to you and got accidentally classified as spam, it could be in there. Or if you accidentally deleted the message, it could be in the trash. And any of the standard search techniques in Gmail will not find it in those locations. If you hit the chevron, there is one option in there that does actually search all locations, and that's mail and spam and trash. So if you really want to search against all everything against your whole mailbox, that's the thing to go for. I'm going to talk a little bit about the internal organization of Gmail. So for the most part, Gmail actually sees your mailbox as being one single repository of everything. It uses labels to fake out folders. It doesn't have a concept of folders at all, and so it uses labels to sort of create an illusion of that. An email can have multiple labels, and if you have multiple labels on it, it will show up in various locations. So if you go to your labels and you search on, or you select it, you'll see emails that have inbox label as well as your whatever selected label you had. And like I say, you can have as many labels on it as you want. Now, nuances on this. If you copy an email from, say, for example, inbox to vacations, Gmail doesn't actually have a copy button. So you choose labels, and it will add the label vacations, and it keeps the label inbox. So you'll see that email whether you're looking at your inbox or the vacations label. On the other hand, okay, there's where you go to add a label to it. So you click on labels and you choose a particular label that you want. In this case, vacations, apply, and it will have both vacations as well as inbox on the labels. On the other hand, if you move an email from inbox to vacations, it'll add the vacations label and it'll remove the inbox label, so you no longer will see it when you're viewing your inbox. So that's the move to button in Gmail. And so if you select a message, click on that, and then you choose a particular label, it will remove the inbox label and just give it the label that you chose there. If you archive an email, Gmail will remove the inbox label And that's all it does, is it just removes the inbox label, so you no longer see it when you're on your inbox. And there's the archive button in Gmail. So to click on that, it just removes the inbox label. So there are two special areas in Gmail, still within that one bucket. But spam and trash are treated a little bit differently in that it allows Google to actually apply retention rules. So by default, anything that's in spam or trash will be automatically deleted after 30 days. And again, those areas normally ignored when searching. So you can search specifically on trash or spam, either from the advanced dialog box, or if you just search using the term in:trash or in:spam, and you can combine it with other things like, you know, in trash and the word Florida. So any email with the word Florida in it, or in spam space Ottawa. You know, emails classified as spam with the word Ottawa somewhere in there. So to find all emails, you can also use, rather than going to the advanced search dialog box, you can actually add the prefix in:anywhere. And that's essentially what you will get if you go in and you do that advanced search and you choose the location and you choose mail and spam and trash. It'll actually do that tag of in:anywhere. You can combine it with other search operators. So you can have it, you know, from : and an email address, or after : and a date, or subject. And you can do phrases where you put it in quotes, and then newer than 2 days, things like that. There's all kinds of things you can actually add to that to narrow down your searches. Or use that advanced search, as I pointed out before, and just making sure that you go to the search in and go to mail and spam and trash. It's the equivalent of in:anywhere. So once you find that message that got waylaid somehow, you want to make sure that you can find it more easily in the future. So the easiest thing is to right-click on the message and choose Move to Inbox. And that'll put the inbox label back on it so that you'll be able to see it when you're in your inbox. Or you can right-click and say Move to a label, and it'll actually just add that particular label, so you'll only see it when you are, you know, viewing that particular label. Or if it had been labeled as spam, you can right-click on it and say not spam, and that will move it back to the inbox. There are a whole bunch of other parameters that you can use when searching email. So I pasted this into the chat as well. But basically the first one, searching an email, is just a generic thing. And then there are some things that are very specific to the desktop as well as Android. And so if you want, you can look at those other links on that to find more things that you can do searching your emails. And that's all I have on that. And
okay, so Natalia is asking Chris, if a message is sent and then labeled, if it's deleted from sent, will it be deleted altogether or kept with the label that was given to it?
I haven't tested that specifically, but my thinking about the way that I've seen things happening, I think it will remain as long as it has a label attached to it. If you delete it from sent and you don't add some other label, then it will go to the trash.
And Tom says, I think this relates to labels. This also applies to Google Contacts and schedule ?
Okay, I didn't know it applied to contacts, but I haven't played around with that. And in terms of schedule, do you mean scheduling the sending of an email? And I'm not sure how that would actually play out. I've never actually tried that. I've never actually scheduled sending of an email. So I don't know how that would play out. I would personally, without testing it, I wouldn't try to delete the message or anything like that until after it has actually been through a scheduled send. But that's just a guess on my part.
Oh. Soon testing required. Okay.
Yeah.
We'll leave that to Tom. He can figure that out.
Okay.
Thanks, Tom. Okay, thank you very much, Chris. I'm going to move on to a next segment, which I've got, which is about vibe coding. And so those of you who've been following this kind of disjointed mini-series. And you'll remember that vibe coding is basically using a chatbot to create a program, some kind of application, by telling it what you want, letting it write the code. You don't actually review the code, you don't edit the code, you don't do anything with it except run the code. So you tell the bot what you want to do, it provides some code, you run that code, and then if it doesn't work the way that you thought it was going to, then you give the bot a new prompt, and you continue that process until the code that's generated automatically by this bot actually creates the application or the program, the script, whatever you're trying to create, that makes it work the way that you want it to. So far in this series, we've had a number of examples of things that you can do, fairly simple things. And most recently, I've been working on a more complicated application, which we'll come back to in a minute. And however, the whole point of this process is that we were looking at having a vibe coding competition for people who attend our meetings. We decided that we would offer two prizes. One would be for the most useful application, however we're going to define that, whatever people think is the best end product that somebody has developed. And then because not everybody is maybe going to be a wonderful vibe programmer, we were also going to give a second prize to the person who gives the best presentation on how they developed or at least tried to develop their application. So we have three promised presentations on vibe coded applications. And so the plan is that this will be our October meeting. And so if you have aspirations to be a vibe coding programmer and you want to tell us your experience, then just let me know, with us, like Chris and I know, at suggestion box, what you plan to do, and we'll make sure that happens, as I say, at the October meeting. Right, so let's carry on with my mini series now. And this is WMatch. This is a an old PC Magazine program. PC Magazine used to develop these applications and basically give them away, and then eventually they sold them, and then eventually they dropped them all together, I think. But this is what I found really useful. It's basically a file and folder comparison utility. As you can see, there are two panes. You can choose a folder, a drive, a folder, on the drive on each side, and then it will actually compare the contents of those two folders. So here you can see that they both have a number of folders by the little blue icons. And you can see that on the left panel, my D drive here has a thing called recycle bin, dollar recycle bin, but that file, that folder, is not present on my backup flash drive. And by the same token, my backup flash drive has a recycle bin called Trash 1000, which is a Linux trash bin, that doesn't appear on my D drive. And then after all the folders here, you can see that here there's a Python script file, which exists on the left-hand side, but not on the right-hand side. There's a free file sync database file here, a hidden file, a dot file, which exists on both sides, but is different. The red X says that these two files are not exactly the same. And you can see that one is a different size than the other one, but they both have the same date timestamp. So they are different because they're different sizes. And then by the same token, the bottom three files here are exactly the same, in terms of size and date time, so they get a blue check mark. So that's the kind of thing that I'm trying to replicate in this vibe coded process. And so far, I have asked the bot if it knows about WMatch, and it said it did. It knew all about PC Magazine's WMatch utility, and it recommended that I use Python to try and replicate it. So it's been creating some Python program code for me. I've been running it, and so far it's developed this, which is somewhat similar to the PC Magazine utility. You can see I've got two different windows with files and folders and some kind of scroll bars there. But we're not quite at the point of having WMatch replicated in any meaningful way anyway. So far, just by telling it to do things
I don't know how to get to...
I said the food was good.
Yeah.
Hang on a second.
So far I've just been telling it to do things like WMatch did previously, and it's been recommending, well, now I've done this, the next thing to do is this, and the next thing to do is this, and I've just kind of gone along with that. So you can see basically I've got the ability to select the folders that I want to be compared in the left and right windows. I can double click on a folder, and that will bring up the contents of that folder, so that's kind of changing the directories. And I have some buttons, if you notice, that will copy files from left to right between the two folders. But the files and the file names are not synchronized in the display, so that's really not very useful. So I have to synchronize the scroll bars so the files and the folder names will be aligned, so it's easy to see what's the same and what's different. And PC Magazine has a much nicer way of showing how the files are different, that red X and the blue check mark and the arrows and stuff. So I need a central column which will give me that status of the file. And I also need the ability to be able to sort the file listings just by clicking on the name or the size or the date timestamp and sort the display in any of those ways that I want to do. So I'm kind of at the stage now where I need to start giving it some prompts because it's not doing exactly what I want it to do. So I'm going to give it this prompt here to add the central column, and I want that to indicate the status of each file pair. And if the files have the same date timestamp, that's basically the way that's the basic way that the files are compared, just on date time, then place a blue check mark in the central column. Otherwise, put an arrow pointing towards the file that has the newest date timestamp, so I know which one is the most recent. So it says, to add the column, you need to do this. You have to have three aligned tables, and we're going to have a blue check mark and arrows and all kinds of wonderful things. So we're ready to generate some code, and then we'll run that code. And all right, so you can see now I've got a central column, I've got some blue check marks, I've got my files and my folders, but you can see that the second one down here is a ethos to do file, and that doesn't align with this HTML file about gathering news across Canada. In fact, that file on the right hand side is way down here on the left hand side. So clearly, these file and folder listings are not aligned, which is what I wanted them to be. And it's a bit worse than that, because if you notice, what it's really done is it's developed three columns, but it's also developed three completely independent scroll bars. So I can scroll the listings up and down, but they're completely independent. They're not synchronized. So that's not terribly useful. And then the other thing, with my eyesight anyway, It's given me an arrow, some arrows here at the bottom, but I mean, I can tell which way they're pointing, but they're not very clear. I would have preferred bigger arrows or something to tell me what's going on. So let's go back to the prompt and try again. And let's tell it, all right, now we've got our three scroll bars, so let's consolidate those into a single scroll bar on the right-hand side. And then I want to maintain the synchronization for files in both tables, so a one-for-one comparison between the two windows. And I want to change the arrows to basically chevrons, because I thought chevrons would be easier to see which way they were pointing. And so it says it's going to do all that kind of wonderful things, and it says right here, it mimics how classic tools like PC Magazine's WMatch kept rows visually aligned. So there you go. So it'll create some more code, and we're going to run it again. And now we can see, okay, now we have indeed combined, we've only got one scroll bar on the right-hand side, and it has indeed lined up these folders here, and this cross kind of the news gatherer file is aligned. So it's done more or less what I said. It's got the scroll bar, one scroll bar instead of three, and it's now synchronized the file and folder listings down the table. So it's really easy to find out which files are the same, which files and folders are the same, and which ones are different. And I get the check marks, and I get some chevrons up here if things are different. Chevrons aren't huge still, but maybe we'll fix that later on. However, there were some problems. It does all these wonderful things, but then it doesn't quite work the way that you think it should. When I told it to do something or other, it hit the right scroll bar. It hit all the scroll bars. They all went away. Then that meant you couldn't scroll the tables because there were no scroll bars. And then once I fixed that, then I had a master scroll bar. But if I changed directories by double clicking on the folder, then again, there was no scroll bar. So I couldn't scroll up and down on the file. So, this vibe code is wonderful stuff. It does more or less what you tell it, but it also does a whole bunch of things that you don't really expect. So here it says, good catch. And the problem comes from how the master scroll bar range is initialized. And it did it before Qt, which is a Linux type program, before it had figured out what the table layout was. So it needs to go back and fix that. So again, we get some more code, and this time we've got some files here, we've got some folders down here, we've got check marks, we've got chevrons. Does anybody notice anything that we've lost that we had before? It's not terribly obvious, maybe. Anyway, let's see how we're doing on this thing. So we can now select the folders to be compared. That was a problem way early on. We can double click to change directories and see the contents of individual folders. Now the files and folder names are in fact synchronized. We have a single scroll bar, so we can scroll up and down the listings very easily. And we've got a central column that tells us what the file status is, so that's okay. The thing that disappeared was the ability to actually copy the files. So once you find a file that's different that you want to copy over, for some reason, it had them in a version earlier. Now it's just dropped out the copy left and copy right buttons. And it still hasn't sorted out the sorting the file listings, but sorting the file listings by name, size, and date time. So I think I mentioned a long time ago, when you're doing vibe coding, it creates code automatically and it does things. It may not necessarily do what you want, and patience is required. And the other thing that happens is it will regrade certain things. It will create aspects of the program. You'll tell it to change something, and it will also get rid of an earlier feature that you didn't mention. So I think sometimes you have to be really specific, and you definitely have to be very patient with vibe coding. Anyway, it's really fun. It's really exciting to see what it will do and what can go wrong and how to fix it. So if you have any interest at all in vibe coding, remember we have a competition coming up in October, and I'd love to see your efforts at that time.
And you can poke fun at it too and see if it gets the joke.
Oh, I haven't tried that.
Yeah.
I have enough trouble trying to get it to do what I want without making
it. On one I did, it was supposed to make one sound, and instead it kept making four sounds. So I said, well, yeah, but it's more like musical chairs than what I was. So then after a while, it tried to reduce the thing, and it screwed it up completely. And so I said, well, does it know any other tunes? Instead of getting that joke, it came up and said, well, yeah, I can put in a different sound for this one, that.
Yeah, obviously most of the AIs don't have a sense of humor.
Well, it did on some. It actually put ha-ha after that.
This idea of vibe coding dropping some things it had before as it builds new things or corrects other things, that seems to be common amongst a lot of AI things. I run into that on image generation, where you ask if it to correct one thing, it'll change everything that it had in the image. Lots of fun.
Yeah, so I'm wondering, Chris, where the answer is that you say, based exactly on what you've done previously, don't change anything other than to this, this, and this.
It might help. Who knows?
I don't know.
And it'll give you an empty ice cream cone, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just like talking to a five-year-old. Come on, guys.
Yeah, that's about right, yeah. It's a very clever five-year-old, I must say. Okay, up to you, Chris, next.
Okay. So this is something I came across that I just thought was kind of interesting, online notepad, and it's a free online editor, and so it has lots of typical editing features, bolding, underlining, paragraphs, and things like that, but it also has AI, and of course, everything is better with AI, right? And so I haven't looked at this an awful lot, but I've played around a little bit with it to see what it could actually do for or against me. And it can help you write new content. So this is the AI aspects of a notepad. So it can help you write brand new content, or if you feed it existing text, it can either paraphrase it or summarize it. And so here's the one where you say, help me write. And so this is, I want something brand new. So in this case here, it said, help me write a friendly 4-to-5-sentence email to my colleague asking for feedback on a document by Wednesday. And it came back with this, and it's not bad. I mean, hope you're having a good week, so a nice intro into it. I finished drafting the document and would appreciate it if you'd take look at it, things like that. And there is a refine with prompt available there. So I decided to say, oh, mention how you know she's really busy, but that's actually part of her job. And so it came back, and it said, I understand you're very busy. The highlighting is mine on here, by the way. And rather than saying, this is your job, it said, this is part of your role, after all. So a little bit more formal or something like that, I guess, but that's fine. Here I said, I want to write an article about the benefits of becoming a member of the Ottawa Peace User Group, whose website is at, and I just gave it the website, and I let it figure out what should it actually come up with. And I was pretty amazed. So you can download this later on if you want as a PDF and look at what it came up with, but it came up with a pretty good description of what is the benefit of being a member of the Ottawa Peace User Group just by being sent to our webpage. And so you can export in Microsoft Word or a PDF file or plain text if you want. So here it is in a Word document format. So it came up really, really nicely formatted with headings and everything like that. I thought it did a really quite a decent job at that. The paraphraser, you feed it text on the left-hand side, and then it will rewrite that text. They say, keeping the meaning, improving clarity, tone, and readability, and it usually will be about the same length. And it'll highlight the things that it's actually modified on it. So you can look at it and say, oh, yeah, that looks pretty good, or that doesn't look good. And you can go in and customize it however you see fit. The summarizer will actually reduce the size of the text. So I took that text, the output from the benefits of being a member of the group, and I asked it to summarize it. And so it went from 487 words down to 150 words. That was not bad. And it actually had a summary too, which was down to 135 words. So it automatically seems to give you two summaries that you can choose from. And again, you can go in and edit those as you see fit. But it seems to do, you know, overall, it seems to do a not bad job of all of those tasks. Now, this next slide, it comes from my presentation on artificial intelligence. And so, is AI a magic box? So this online notepad, you know, will it actually generate any new content that I want it to? You know, and have it really good? Will it summarize it correctly? Will it, rephrase it correctly without making all that mistakes? And, you know, sometimes these things do work that well, as the woman in the cartoon will attest to. But AI can also give incomplete answers and confident, plausible sounding answers that are completely wrong, as the guy will attest to from this cartoon. And so really what you have to do is, there are hallucinations that can happen. So when I asked it for, you know, what are the benefits of being a member of the Ottawa PC User Group, I would want to read that really carefully and make sure that they didn't say, oh, and they'll give you $100 if you stick around for a year or something like that. Who knows what it's going to come up with on its own. So the important thing is don't blindly trust AI. If it's important that the answer that it puts out is correct, it's always up to you to verify. And that's all I have for that.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. Yeah, sounds like vibe coding. Always very fun.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, interesting that Chris would find something about Notepad, because I had this thing about text editors. This is part of our 2x2 series where we look at two programs that basically do the same task and look at some other similarities and differences between the two. So for this one, I've chosen Notepad, which is the Windows text editor, and Notepad++, which is, in my view, a refined version, I guess. So Notepad is actually built into Windows. It's probably almost been there for a long time. And it's basically just a plain text editor. So you can open TXT files and anything that is text-based, HTML, CFGs, that kind of thing. If you want to run two files at the same time, then you can open a second instance of Notepad by using File and New Window, and then you'll have two Notepad windows where you can have two different files open at the same time. The menu also gives you the option of changing the font that's being used, the style, boldface, italic, that kind of stuff, and also the size of the text that you are reading. And it also it has search and replace for the current file that's in the window, and you have zoom controls so you can make things bigger and smaller just by zooming the window's contents. So some of the options, for example, if you want to change the font, then you go to, I think it's Format, and then that brings up a font option. And you can see here you can choose different fonts. Of course, Chris loves to choose Comic Sans MS. I think that's his favorite font of all time. And you can have regular italic, or you can have bold italic here. And you can choose different size fonts. So whatever font you really like, you have quite a few options there in terms of what you can display in the window. And this is the find command. So I've got a file open here, which is actually the listing of topics for Q&A. And I've asked it to find Power Toy, because Chris is always interested in power toys. So it's gone down there and it finds that he did a share on a new Microsoft Power Toy on May the 20th. So it has simple text editing capabilities, and it has some fancy features that are actually quite useful. So what about Notepad++? This is an open source program by a guy called Don Hall, and you can download it from the URL here. And he positions this as a notepad replacement. But remember, it's plus-plus, so it's got a lot of additional features over Notepad. So in addition to being able to open and edit text files, it also knows about programming languages. So if you're actually writing program code yourself, and that it would include HTML or Python scripts and a whole raft of others, then it has some special capabilities that will help you do that. It has, by default, it will open multiple files in separate tabs. So you can open, two files or three files or multiple files, and each has a tab within the window. And that's by default. You can change that in the settings, and you can have it open separate windows, just like Notepad does. But there are also many tools and many options, and the whole thing is very configurable. So it's much more sophisticated in a lot of ways than the simple Microsoft Notepad. As I say, it has programming language support. It knows about dozens of different programming languages, and we'll see an example of that in a minute. And the other thing it will do is it will actually let you record macros. So you do a start recording, you type how you're going to process your file, and it will record the keystrokes as a macro, and then you can actually play those back later on at any time you wish. And another powerful feature it has is the ability to download and install plugins. And one I use a lot is Compare. So it compares two files in two separate windows and will show you the similarities and differences in those two files, which can be really, really useful. So here is Notepad++, and you will see here that I've got three different files open under the red box there, and they're all in different tabs. And the one that's live is this Python script file here. And you can see that because it knows that this is Python, I didn't tell it, it just knows that a PY file is Python program, so it decides that it's going to color code the comments in green, some important keywords in blue, and some other things down here in, I guess that's purple, I think. Anyway, so you get a whole bunch of assistance here in being able to easily find the code from the comments, for example. Okay, when you notice that it has a one of these file edit view type menus here, but it's got a lot of different things here, tools and macros and plugins and search and view. And when you click on any one of these options, one of these menu items, typically you get a drop down menu, a context menu, a lot of kinds of things that you can do under that category. So, for example, in search, you've got the usual find and you've got replace, which work as you would expect. And so I think if I do this, here I've been looking for, I've gone back to that index of Q&A options, and I've asked it to find Vibe Coding, and it's found the first entry here was an entry for part 7 that was going to be used this week, in fact. And you can see here that you've got a lot of different things you can choose from. You can go backwards and you can match whole words, you can match the case, and you can do all kinds of clever things with the find command, find and replace command. This one is really neat, I think, find in files. So now if you think that you've opened a file or you've opened a folder, and what you want to do is look for files within that folder that have a certain text string, it will actually search all of the files in that one folder for that particular text string. And that can be really useful. So for example, I know that when I run GIMP, I sometimes want to create a transparent image of the foreground object. So I want to get rid of the background. So What I'm going to do is I'm going to look in this folder that I've opened and look for transparent. So I told it, I want you to find transparent for all files, and I want you to look in this directory called agtemp on my D drive. I want you to find all. And so off it goes, and it says it's got four hits, and you notice in dtemp there's a file called help-gimp-transparent-background.txt, and it had three occurrences of transparent. And there's also a file called help-photoscape-x, courtesy of Linda, transparent-background.txt, and it had one hit. So these are basically my instructions to myself, because I don't do this very often. This is how you create a transparent background in GIMP, and this is how you do it in Photoscape-X. So when you open that file, this is the text file, here, open the image, select the area, click the region you want, and do this, that, and the other, create a layer, and that kind of stuff. So when I want to create a transparent image, then that's the way that I can find out how to do it. And talking about plugins, I mentioned the plugin for the compare. So when you select plugins and compare, then you hit the I've got two files open, right? This file here is on my D drive. This file here is on my backup flash drive. They're nominally the same file, but this will be the current file, and this will be the backup file from probably last week. So I say compare those two files, and it shows me the differences are in blue in this one and green in this one. So this one was May the 27th. So this is clearly the older file, actually. And this is June 3rd. So this is this week's file, which is in the process of being built. And then down here, there were some files that had some slight differences, 13 there, 14 there. That's because I used 13 somewhere, I guess. And there's version 7 that was used up here, so I've now changed that to be version 8. So I can very easily see the differences in those two text files. And then finally here, under the settings menu, there are dozens of settings under the preferences menu, and settings and preferences, and then you can change general toolbars and how you edit things and highlighting and printing and searching, and they all have different things that you can do there. So if you're at all interested in a much more versatile, shall we say, version of Notepad, I highly recommend downloading and installing Notepad++. Now, the next two questions. Does anybody have any other text editors that they use and would recommend? And B, does anybody have any 2x2 contributions that they would like to make for the group? Some kind of applications that you use, or you think that one is better than the other? And as usual, just let us know in suggestion box, and we'll be happy to take care of things. Okay, that's all I have, Chris, for that.
Okay, Tom just had one comment. PSPad is comparable to Notepad++. And Harvey mentions TextPad. I actually use TextPad as well. Quite like it. It's not free. It's, I believe, shareware. So, again, if anybody has any of those contributions, certainly feed it into suggestion box.
And what about PSPad, Tom? Is that a free program?
Okay, while we wait for a reply on that, we'll move on.
Well, no, Richard's got his hand up.
Go on, okay, Richard. Yep.
Just wondering if any of them actually run on Linux as well as DOS.
Notepad will under Wine. Mm-hmm. But by the same token, you've got gedit, which is a really good Linux text editor. And you've also got, what is it, Notepad++.
Well, there's another one Google has called Google Keep. If you ever tried that one works really well. You can make shopping lists and all sorts of things with it and paste internet shortcuts and everything else.
Yeah, I have to look up the Linux one. It's something like NotepadQQ or something like that. I forget what the thing is.
If you want to go the other way for something simpler, I believe that Microsoft open sourced and has updated the original MS-DOS edit utility.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's going back a ways.
Okay, let's move on. So we had this question come in to suggestion box, somebody who was trying to access a web service or a website that had something that they had to log in to actually get information from. And it required authentication using both a user ID as well as it had to have a tie to a Microsoft account. And they had no problem in the past before the requirement was added to use a Microsoft account. And now they're getting this error message, so basically saying the user account, their Gmail account that they're actually logging in with, does not exist in tenant and then the company name. And the account needs to be added as an external user in the tenant first, so one of these typical error messages that are rather difficult to understand what they're all about. And or sign in again with a different Azure Active Directory user account. And so the person verified there was nothing wrong with the Microsoft account itself. They were able to log in just into the account. And curiously, if they were accessing the same site from Brazil with the same credentials and the same Microsoft account, they got no error message and they were able to get in. That gave me a little bit of a clue, but I looked at it and I thought there's some guesses about it. So first off, asking Copilot, given this is something Alan looked up, said because it's Azure for Microsoft, figured Copilot should know about it. And so abbreviated below, so we have some stuff here. The portal belongs to a specific company. The account is from live.com, so that's the Microsoft personal account for the Microsoft account, not from their tenant. And you're not registered as a guest or an external user in that Azure ID, so that tenant. Because of that, it's blocking it. And it's a tenant mismatch problem, not a password or a browser issue, is the conclusion that Copilot came to. So they said how to fix it. Basically, the company has to add your Microsoft account into their tenant as a guest user. There were some options. I don't think any of these would actually come into play. They said maybe clearing your cache sessions might help it. And I don't think that that would actually come into play to helping you out at all. Now, where they said they were able to get in from when they were in Brazil, that made me think that maybe what they're doing is they're not really tying it in so much to that Microsoft account, but they're actually just looking to see if you're coming from Brazil. And if that's the case, maybe a VPN that has a server in Brazil that you can send all your traffic through, that might actually work to solve the problem. And just wondering if anybody else has any other ideas that this person might try.
Okay, so if anybody knows anything, put something in the chat and we'll get back to that.
Okay,
and this next item is a share from Stuart. Basically, Google now, if you do a search on Google, you'll find that the first hit, if you like, is usually an AI summary of what you're asking about. And some people find that tedious and not very useful or something. And so people have figured out ways to get rid of that. And this is an article from an agency called Tedium, which tells you how to basically get back to Google's original search facility and get rid of that AI summary. And if you're more interested in how that actually does it, then the second link here is for the search engine that does that for you. Okay, so there you go. If you're interested in getting rid of the AI summary in Google and maybe some other search engines, then there is a link to maybe help you do that. Okay, next up we had this is for the musicians in the audience. Leo Gregory from Men's Shed, Ottawa, they have a ukulele group, and their ukulele group now includes some regular guitars. However, they have a songbook. They're using software called Songbook Pro, and they have 812 songs with set up for ukulele. So his question is there software that will convert the ukulele chords, which are only use four chords, and show the same chords basically for a standard six-string guitar? And so the goal was to show the chord chart for guitars while the other members of the group can use the regular one for ukuleles. So that is beyond Chris and I's limited experience with music. And if anybody knows how to do that, let us know and we will do a follow-up and certainly follow up with Leo on that aspect. And the next thing I have is from Natalie, and she's pointing out that Samsung is going to shut down their messaging app. So Samsung Messages is going to be shut down in July, and they're telling users to switch to Google Messages. And the website says that this is for the US only, and Natalie hasn't been able to find anything that reflects on this issue in Canada, but she thinks it's going to affect us all in the near future. And so her questions are, if these things are going to be integrated, is it best to switch to Google Messages, or should she be considering another messaging application? And is there a reliable site that will compare messaging apps? And Samsung says that if you set up Google Messages as your default SMS app and move away from Samsung Messages, all the Samsung messages will be migrated to Google Messages within 24 hours. Natalie is clearly cautious in this respect, and she wants to know if there's a way to back up everything in Samsung Messages before switching to another app. So if anybody is using a Samsung and knows anything about that, again, we'd be interested in knowing your experience, your interest, or whatever. I do actually know a little bit about Samsung Backup, and Samsung does have this program called Smart Switch, and it's really designed, if you buy a new Samsung phone, it's really designed to transfer all of your data from the old phone to the new phone. However, it also has some capabilities to do backup, and it will do backup of a phone, the old phone, any phone really. It will do backup of the contents of the phone to the cloud. It will do it to a PC, and it will do it to a USB drive. And this YouTube video basically talks about all of the above. So if you have a Samsung phone, then Smart Switch can be downloaded, installed, and used to back up your information from your phone. I imagine that other manufacturers have a similar kind of product. And again, if you're aware of anything like that for other phone manufacturers, we'd be interested to know and pass that along. There is some interest in how you back up the contents of phones, for example. It's not crystal clear, I don't think. So that's all I had on that, Chris. Is there anything else?
No, haven't seen anything about this switching of apps. I seem to remember it in the news a couple of weeks ago. So this is the idea of Samsung messages going away. Tom says, for what it's worth, he prefers the WhatsApp messaging. So if you want to switch to something other than Google, Sejerik, for those interested, tomorrow, well, this is unrelated, I guess, it's Government of Canada is officially launching their new AI strategy. I guess I should pay attention to that. Called Canada's National Artificial Intelligence Strategy, AI for All. So who knows what the government will come up with on there?
Just a thought there. WhatsApp messaging, does WhatsApp do SMS? I thought WhatsApp was...
It's not SMS.
Client to client.
Yeah, it's not SMS, but it has its own protocol and so forth that it uses.
Yeah, but I think this is an SMS messaging app that is of interest here.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, so the final thing I have is again from Natalie. She says that over the years she's enjoyed a lot of information from the Royal Canadian Institute for Science. And this is Canada's oldest scientific organization. It's been going for 175 years, but not everybody is aware of it. And it's now a registered charity, and they do a lot of communications of science to the public. And the website is rcischience.ca. And Natalie says that they have a lot of live events and webinars, and they record these and post them to YouTube. So if you go to their website, they'll tell you when their various events are. But if you miss them, then you might be able to pick them up on this YouTube channel. Now, they have a lot of topics from a scientific perspective, obviously. And she quotes things like baking and sun safety and wildfires and that kind of stuff. An interesting interview there with Jeffrey Hinton, who won the Nobel Prize for his work on artificial intelligence. Surprise, surprise. In a collaboration series, so if you want to look at that interview, that's there. And they also have a new series called The Curious Mindset, looking at upcoming biomedical research. So those are all scientific information type options that you can get from RCI Science as a Learning Link. So it's a Canadian link on the web with lots of scientific-based information. Okay, so I think we've got a couple of minutes here, 4 minutes maybe. Does anybody have any questions, comments, or things that you would like to share with the group?
We did have one thing going into the chat from Stu on that Samsung replacing with Google Messages, and so he has a link to a Mobile Syrup article. So anybody who's affected by that, you might want to check out that link as well.
Hi. I've been having a problem with the settings for the audio on Zoom. Whenever I went there, it abended. That's IBM speak for abnormal end. In other words, it quit. But I found that in the regular gallery view, I have the audio, video, and a whole bunch of buttons down the bottom. And if I go to the audio view and click on the audio chevron next to it, I can then edit the audio settings, and so now I can speak to you unlike before. Hi!
Success. So was this just after an update to the Zoom client or something silly like that?
It's been bothering me for the last, month, 2 months or so. That's why you haven't heard me as much.
Well, those options have been there forever.
Oh, the options have been there forever. But when I use the Zoom ordinary screen and then go to my profile and go to settings and click audio, Zoom would quit, which is surprising because I've never been able to make Zoom quit otherwise. When you exit it, it hangs around and around and around. But if you go to once you start to Zoom, if you go to the gallery and look at the bottom on all those buttons, on the left side there's audio and video. And if you click the chevron there, then you get a whole bunch of settings. You can select a microphone, a speaker, microphone modes, and test the speaker and so on. Et cetera, including it. So that is how I managed to actually turn on my microphone.
Very interesting.
For Zoom.
Well, maybe somebody would like to do a share on that for us. Hint, hint.
Gentle nudge there, Tom.
Okay, well, everybody's thinking about what to say next. I'm going to go into the wrap-up and talk about the upcoming presentations at the library. I haven't heard that any of these are cancelled, so On Saturday, Chris is presenting in Greeley at 1 p.m. in the afternoon on artificial intelligence, fun and useful tips. And at 2 o'clock at the Centennial Branch, Linda will be discussing how to organize and showcase your photos, your digital photos. And then on Monday, June the 8th at 5:30 p.m. in Richmond, Chris is going to be giving all the details about the ins and outs of electronic mail. As usual, if you want to attend any of those, use the URL at the bottom of the slide there to register with the library. And at that same link, you will also find all of the other presentations that are upcoming following these three. So there are lots of lots of programs that you can attend. You just have to look them up on that website. Next week is our pizza queue, our pizza party at Britannia Park. So if you're a member of the club and you want to come and join the party, you need to register with Harvey by email. Send him an email to this pizzaparty2026@opcug.ca. Tell him who you are, how many people are coming. You and your members and guests are quite welcome. And if you need any assistance in seating, that kind of thing. Oh, and the type of pizza that you like, too. That's another thing. And you'll find all of the information that's required and all of the details about the night at that URL on our website.
And we have a question from Natalie. Where is the pizza coming from this year?
Do we know, Harvey?
Jocelyn is going to make that decision.
Okay.
Not from Italy.
Sorry, what was that?
Not from Italy.
Not from Italy, no.
My guess is Gabrielle's, but there's another one. I forget what the name of it is. But
yeah, we've had it from another place. And it was
wherever we're getting it from, it's really good pizza. It has been so far, so. Okay, so because we have a pizza party, and that means that there will be no Q&A next week. So our next Q&A will actually be in 2 weeks from now, June the 17th. So you've got lots of time to send in your questions and write the share about Zoom editing controls, other shares that you might want to talk about, 2x2s and applications that you find really useful. And just send us a little bit of information about what you want to do or your questions to suggestion box at opcug.ca. And Chris and I will be happy to receive your input and take the appropriate action. Okay, so that's all for me, and I hope to see you at the pizza party next week and at Q&A on the 17th.
Thanks for coming, folks. And Yale just pasted in that the other potential pizza source was Willie's Pizza, which is, right in that neighborhood. So if you want to know, you could email Joss, and I'm sure he'd be happy to let you know.